So welcome, fellow timekeepers. Thank you for joining us. We had such a great time with Anna, aka the Chrono Life Girl, last time out, all the way from Poland. We learned about her Instagram journey and shock horror, her not liking Cartier as much as Zach and I. However, all was forgiven, almost, when she expressed a dislike of the date window. So it's a lady after my own heart, but perhaps not Zach, who does seem to like the date window for whatever reason. We'll have to ask Rebecca and Alan what they think about date windows later on. But do check out the episode if you haven't already. So last time we spoke, we also had Geneva Watch Days come and go. I really wanted to go this year, but twinned with my newborn, another son. So he's 6 weeks old, and obviously work commitments. It wasn't possible, but I really do want to visit next year. And I know the Watch Collectors Club of the UK run a fantastic tour. So Zach and I will definitely be looking into that. Come September next year. I think Zach and I, we're going to do another short pod on Geneva Watch Days. But I think my favourite was, unsurprisingly, Denizen and their Jewel Time. I was already yearning for one this year when it came out, the original ALD, perhaps on the Tiger's Eye, but it just looks incredible. But Zach, I've got a sneaky suspicion that you like a certain type of Zenith Defy chronograph, particularly those colours. So I'll leave you to talk about that in a minute, but that's for another day. So this episode, I'm really delighted to have not one, but as you can see on screen, two special guests. So Dr. Rebecca Struthers and Alom Shaha. And they are the authors of a new book about watches for children called About Time. And as listeners know, as a father of three young sons, and the reason I fell down this sort of horological rabbit hole, as soon as I heard about the book, I knew I had to have you both on the channel. So I'm really glad that you're able to agree and we could make it this evening. But before we go into the interview section, we've got our usual topics. Rebecca, Alan, you're very welcome to join in for those as well. So, Zach, how have you been? And I think you're off to Paris soon. Very jealous. I'm going to have to live vicariously through you. All those vintage arcade watch shops is definitely, I think, what you're going to be doing, right? So, Zach, how have you been? And how's Paris shaping up?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, Tim. First off, welcome, Dr. Rebecca and Alan. It's great to have you on. I've heard great things. So I can't wait to get into this. And I've been well. And yes, I am going to Paris soon and definitely looking into that. That's for sure. And then just branching back to what you mentioned about Geneva Watch Days. I have been looking at the latest releases. I definitely feel like the Zenith DeFi chronograph is definitely a watch that I was looking at for sure. I like the four different colors that it comes with. I think it was green, purple, orange, and like a golden yellow, and then a gentian blue, which was very cool. I didn't manage to make it out there. I know we had some conversations with Chris, the dial artist, and he mentioned that Geneva Watch Days is maybe a better place to visit than Watches of Wonder, due to kind of speaking to kind of the watchmakers and the CEOs and being a bit closer to everything. But unfortunately, I couldn't make it. But maybe next year, that'll be something that I'll go ahead and do. As well as that, Zenith, another two watches kind of stood out to me as I was having a look through the latest releases. And that was the Frederic Constant Classic Premier with their new dials. They definitely stood out to me and they were super cool with the kind of pastel retro hues, classic shapes, like they're called Calatrava style. And also watches that represent great value, as I believe they were a couple hundred pounds cheaper. More rather than their predecessor, so definitely a good possible option. So one of the other watches that stood out to me from Geneva Watch Days was the Laurent Ferrier Classic Tourbillon in teal. The teal green enamel was something that stood out to me. A great piece. I think they're super limited as well, to about five editions, and I think it's just a fantastic looking watch. So those are the two main ones that stood out to me. So I feel like it was a successful Geneva Watch Days, although I didn't get to visit this time around.
No, we'll have to do it again. I don't know, Rebecca, Al, but if you've been to things like this before, like Geneva Watch Days or Watches and Wonders, or would you like to go? What about you, Rebecca?
I haven't, I haven't been to Geneva Watch Days. We've recently restructured the business over the last year to hopefully allow us more time out the workshop, because as it stands, with it being just me and Craig, we are in at the coalface all day, every day. So it'll be nice to do more of this kind of thing, because we'd love to. It's nice. It's just lovely getting out and meeting other watchmakers. So yeah, we should do more of that.
No, absolutely. What about you, Alan?
No, I would probably lust after the watches on show too much and get myself into some kind of financial trouble. So I probably should avoid such shows until my children are old enough that I don't have to worry too much about financially supporting them. Or is that just for life now? I don't know.
Yeah, it could be.
Possibly a bit late for that.
Oh, very good. Very good. Should we move to watches we're lusting after? Like Alan, as you just said, took the words out of my mouth. So for me, Grand Seiko has hit me really hard again. As we move into autumn, sort of the blue and summery like watch dials fade away. I wanted a more sort of moody watch. And I've always thought about like a red or burgundy dial. The latest Cartier Tank, in that burgundy is incredible. But the price hikes from pretty much 2020, 2022 have made this watch unattainable for most. And that's why I wanted to look at Grand Seiko. We don't like doing references too much on this podcast, but it's a long one, but I'm going to read it out anyway. So it's our SBGW 287G. I suppose in the better Japanese, they call it the flow of seasons. And it possesses this sort of rich autumnal colour, and they call it of the Boshu. I probably butchered the pronunciation, and it's basically a season in Japan. The workmanship on the dial is incredible. The macros I've seen on Instagram, I can't wait to try and repeat. And I think for the price point, you get so much quality with Grand Seiko. Again, seeing is believing. Do take a look on our YouTube channel, watch on Spotify video. And I'm sure, Rebecca will have a view on Grand Seiko and their dial creations as well, as a watchmaker herself. Zach, what about you? What's your watch you're lusting after at the moment? And then perhaps we'll go to Rebecca and Alan if you can think of a watch you particularly would like.
Definitely. That's a great choice, that Seiko that you picked with the burgundy dial. I think it was not so long ago when we went to the Grand Seiko boutique and they were very kind in letting us have a look at many of their watches. Could say a lot of them could be on my list that I'm lusting after. Yeah, it's a great looking watch. But for me, it's a watch that I just mentioned, the Laurent Ferrier Classic Tourbillon. I think it's just a stunning looking watch, to be honest. The enamel dial, it blends blue and green tones beautifully, making it unique and really eye-catching to me. I love that it's in a platinum case as well, which makes it look super elegant. And those are quite rare. And of itself, the fact that it has a hidden tourbillon as well is very cool. That's also another plus when kind of showing off your watch or sharing with others. And then the finish is just exquisite to me. I love the polished edges. It's limited to 5 pieces as well. So seeing it at Geneva Watch Days, that's funny enough. It's a brand that I don't usually look at, but a great watch nonetheless to celebrate Laurent Ferrier's 15th anniversary. Limited to 5 pieces, and that's the watch that I'm kind of looking at and lusting over. I'm not sure what you guys think, and would love to hear from you, Rebecca and Alan, if you have any watches that kind of stand out to you this month or any you're lusting over.
Always. For me, like, I love vintage. That's one of my big things. So I just love the style and the design, the kind of size, case sizes, and some of the detail in the dials as well. You just get beautiful. But I think you mentioned them earlier, and it kind of ties into that vintage feel. Denison, just love them. I'm a sucker for a stone dial as well.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I first saw them at the Watch Pro Salon last year. And being a Brummy as well myself, and I heard that they kind of restarted the Denison name again, I was like, there should be a case making company in Birmingham. That's what it deserves to be, and serve the British industry or whatever. And like, I really didn't want to like them. And then when I saw them, I was like, they are beautiful. They are beautiful, beautiful watches. And the price points I just think are phenomenal for a stone dial. They are lovely. Yeah, so I'd like one of them.
Zach and I, we like stone dials, don't we? I managed to get one of the Baltics that came out with a stone dial last year. The one with the lapis. I think it was 250 made of like each one. There was a jade one as well. But yeah, you like the Piagets, don't you? Which we're going to touch on a bit later on, aren't we, Zach?
Yep, we are.
Very good. What about you, Alan? Was there a watch you're particularly really wanting at the moment? I've had to put you on the spot.
There is, but I know I can't have it because it's a one of one. And it's by Rebecca. It's Rebecca's Trench watch. If you look at her website, it's called The Trench, and it was made for a client. And it's just a kind of phenomenal take on the classic Trench watch, but taken to a kind of extreme level of beauty and sophistication, and I think it would look really great on my wrist. So I can't have that one. So like Rebecca, I think I was saying to you before, like I can't afford to splash out on the really kind of luxury watches. So I always keep my eye out for kind of vintage secondhand type things. And what I'd really like next is, so one of the things we look at in the book is the moon phase complication. And yes. I haven't got a watch with a moon phase complication. So there's an Oris tank watch with a pointer date. It's rectangular and it's got a moon phase and it's a relatively small dial. So it would fit on my wrist and it's kind of within my sort of budget, I think. So I kind of might buy a new watch when I get an next book deal or something like that. So it might be the treat for myself if and when the next book deal comes along.
No, that sounds great. I really love the Oris pointer date. One of the reasons sort of why I got into watches was seeing that. So yeah, we definitely love a pointer date here, don't we, Zach?
Yeah.
That's cool. And moon phase is pretty incredible as well. The talk about vintage, the Omega Cosmics as well. I really like the moon phase they've got on there. And one of my favourite, I don't want to use the word Grail watch, but a watch I would really, really love is the Universal Genève Tri-Compacts as well. That is really beautiful with a moon phase. So they keep going up and up in price. And with Breitling, obviously, buying the name up, I know they want to reintroduce the pole router first, but if they ever did a Tri-Compacts again that was modern, I think I'd be all in on that. You like that watch as well, don't you?
I do, yeah. I'm a big fan of the pole router. Definitely a great one to have, especially the ones with the solid gold case as well. Beautiful.
Should we do watch shops of the month? I think, am I going up first? I think I am. So I can never keep it to just one. I've had, three for the last couple of months, haven't I, Zach? And you keep telling me off. So I've got two, because we've got a few more questions for our guests, which I sort of want to cram in as well. So I'm reducing my number to three. So first up, it's got to be Cartier. Am I right? The one that I wanted to pick out is an absolutely insane custom piece from MWB Collective. And it's a Cartier Asymmetrique with a brilliant green dial. And Rebecca, perhaps you can help identify the technique used on the dial itself. I'll flash up on the screen in a minute because I can't even begin to explain sort of the intricate detail. I assume it's a guilloche, but not the specific type. It's kind of wavy. Almost looks like the inside of an umbrella. Maybe it's a rosette style. I mean, do check it out on YouTube. Let me just bring it up here for people to see. Where's it gone? There we go. It's there. But it's very much one of a kind. I'll bring in Rebecca just very shortly. But the font, you know, for the numerals really stands out. It's straight lined. So like the twos look like Zs. The eight resembles almost like a sand timer. And I'm really liking the sloping triangular four as well. The case is silver or platinum, but it really complements the green dial. Zach and I go on and on about cabochons on this pod, and for good reason, because we absolutely love them. I think this Cartier's got a green one. It's hard to tell from the photo, but I 100% fell for it. The light is yellowy brown on sort of the leather strap, and it really draws you into the watch. So basically, I'm in love with it. So huge congrats for Cartier creating it for him. And then next up is someone called the Norman Invasion, and they're incredibly punchy Piaget symmetrical watch, and it's a reference 9467, or so Google tells me. So let me just bring that one up so our listeners can see. There we go. Where is it? There we go. And yeah, again, it's a green dial, which I love. And this is a stone dial. And Rebecca, we're just talking about stone dials. So this is jade, I believe. It's more a rounded K shape than the usual sort of straight lines of the Cartier versions. It's a gold case, and it really works with sort of the cloudy jade dial, and matches perfectly with the gold Dolphin hands. And again, the gold Piaget typeface. Again, I really want this watch. So maybe this section now, Zach, is becoming sort of part watch shots of the month, parts watches I'm lusting after. So Zach, what do you think of those two? Again, I know you have a soft spot Piaget, and then perhaps Rebecca and Alan will get your views on those two watch shots as well. So Zach, over to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think those are great options. Two both green dial watches, which we love, and also like special sort of dials. So that's kind of like stone dial Piaget. And then also this asymmetric. So that asymmetric, I guess, is was customly made for this person, right?
Yeah, very jealous.
Yeah. So I think that's awesome. I've never seen numerals like that, of course. Never seen this kind of combination with strap and also kind of like wave pattern dial with these numerals. So definitely unique and a great, great shot. And then this Piaget, I think it just, it speaks to me. I feel like the kind of the shape, the smoothness of the gold case, and that dial, the minimal kind of design, as well as those kind of like solid gold minute and hour hands as well. So, yeah, both incredible shots. Yeah, I mean, do I go for one now or do I pick one now out of the two? Or do I pick one with my...
Well, why don't you say what you like and then... perhaps we bring in Rebecca and Alan for sort of their views of that. And like I said, I don't know what type of dial that is on the Cartier. So like Rebecca, if you know, then please tell us not to put you on the spot or anything.
I'm just trying to get it up on my phone as well, so I can see a closer image.
So it was MWB Collective on Instagram. It's this green dial watch. There we go. I'm a sucker for fonts as well. So yeah, the font design is pretty incredible as well.
Looks like some sort of Aztec font.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
It's quite unique.
The Cartier is engine turning.
Yeah.
That's really lovely. I mean, it's funny, we were talking about, I mentioned earlier, my love of vintage watches, and both of those watches have very much got that vintage influence to them. And, I mean, I'm a massive Piaget fan as well. For that reason, I love 70s and stone dials. I mean, come on, you've won me over with that.
Yeah, they're making a comeback, aren't they? Some people are already fed up of stone dials already, but clearly they haven't got the memo because they're just awesome. Yeah,
definitely. I love Tiger's Eye as well. Is that terrible? Yeah. It's the ultimate in 70s.
Yeah, it's good. Alan, what do you think about this too?
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of simple dials, and although I was talking about wanting a watch with a moon dial, moon phase complication, I actually prefer a plain watch without too many dials and whatnot, maybe a sub-seconds. But I know you were discussing date windows, and I think most date windows really spoil the kind of elegance of a dial. They just seem obtrusive most of the time. I like a nice simple watch face. I know I saw your 248 the other night, Rebecca, and it's just pure simplicity. It just tells the time. It doesn't even have a second hand. Is that right?
Yep, time only, so hour and minute hand. Yeah, simplicity is a great word to use in terms of referring to a watch. Too, I'll take that.
But it's not in a negative sense at all. I think the simplicity leads to a kind of elegance that I think is missing in overly busy watch styles. And for me, you know, I'd be perfectly happy with a really beautiful watch like the 248, where you've just got the hour and minute hands. So yeah, I'm a fan of such designs.
Peaceful. Definitely. Peaceful.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, so you quite like date windows. Yeah. I don't, because I know I've picked two asymmetrical watches, but I like symmetry. So what the date window breaks all that up. So it really frustrates me. But for some reason, I just felt really drawn to these two asymmetrical watches. Zach, what about you? What have you got for us? I think you shared it to me recently, didn't you, today, the ones you've picked out for us. So you have a go and flash it up on screen as well. They're really good, particularly the... Well, no, I'll let you do it. You go. You pick the ones.
Perfect. So the first one I have is from Ivan Watches One on Instagram. And it's a picture of a now sold Rolex Oyster Quartz day date, reference 19018. And it features a rare birch burlwood dial, which almost appears as if it's floating. In this kind of photo. Oh, thank you. I was thinking, how am I going to speak and then show up? But thanks,
Tim. We'll put it up properly as well when I edit it. But yeah, cool.
Yeah. And it has great lighting. It shows off the gold and the wood dial without a glare, which is really good. It's kind of illuminated under that kind of natural lighting. I love the dial texture that stands out in the picture. Kind of making note of that kind of unique dial material, grain wood dial material. And also the details, like the hands look really sharp and clear on the shot, which is also great to see the detail. I love the positioning as well, the diagonal positioning of the shot, which kind of makes it more interesting than just a standard shot. The background matches quite well. So soft and neutral surface that makes the watch pop. I don't know if it's a carpet or something that's being held over, but it works really well with the contrast of the watch being held over it or taking a shot over it. It looks clean and elegant, no clutter in the kind of shot, and shows the great condition of the watch too. So that's definitely my first choice. My second choice of shot of the month is from og.vintage.watch on Instagram, and it's of a 1950s JLC Memovox with a lapis lazul dial. That's something that maybe Rebecca would like.
This is incredible, Barnett window.
The dial is super captivating, and I think the shot's incredible because the lighting just captures the details well. It's not too harsh for reflections. The dial really pops with its deluxe texture.
Zach, deluxe.
The lugs
are incredible.
Yeah, the lugs, incredible detail. And the focus is super sharp in the shot. So you can see clearly the hands, indices, and even the date window. But I know that Alan and Tim are not really great fans of the date windows. And maybe Rebecca is not a great fan of date windows. But I don't mind them personally. I feel like the gold case and blue strap and the blue dial all work beautifully together in the shot. The angle is great at a slight tilt, which gives depth and avoids distortion of the watch. And also there's a clean background, which keeps the viewers focused on the main thing, and that's the watch. So those are the two for myself. I'll try to see if I can bring up that second watch for you. I think Tim had shown it.
I flashed it up. Yeah. Rebecca, I don't know what you think about either of those two watches, and then perhaps Alan as well.
Well, again, you can't lose with a stone dial. And about date windows. So for me, date windows are just a utility thing, perhaps. Like, they don't bother me. But they are functional as opposed to something really elegant. I think pointer dates are kind of your different sort of your alternative date displays are elegant and interesting, and a window is utility, perhaps. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I like the IWC pilot chronographs though, where they have like a day the date as well, which is quite nice. And perhaps even the day date Rolexes are just about passable for me. But Alan, what about you? Do you like those two?
I pick the JLC. I think it's elegant, and the stone dial makes it really special. But again, yes, the date window breaks the symmetry and is unnecessary, quite frankly.
Cool. No, that sounds good. Because we have a bit of merch, don't we, Zach? We have a beer mat, a Timekeeper's beer mat. And we usually get our guests to pick their favourite out of the ones we pick. So I don't know if you did have a favourite out of the ones that Zach and I had. Obviously, there was the Cartier, there was the Piaget, both the green dials that were asymmetrical. And Zach, obviously, you had the Rolex, which looked really nice, by the way. Was it that birchwood dial? And obviously, the lapis for the Jaeger that you had as well. I love the lugs on that one as well, in particular. That's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know, Rebecca or Alan, if you had a favourite, if you had to pick, put you on the spot.
I had to pick probably the Piaget, I think, for me. Yeah.
The JLC, I think.
Oh, there we go. There we go. Well, we'll notify the people and perhaps they can get one each and and they can get a beer mat if they want one. So, not many watch brands give off free merch. Not many watch podcasts do as well. So, the beer mat definitely works. So that's cool. Right. So shall we move into the sort of meat of the podcast, which is obviously having Rebecca and Alon here. So I sent you through a number of questions beforehand. We'll try and get through as many as we can. I've definitely broken it up in terms of like book specific questions and then more philosophical ones, if I'm allowed to, and then perhaps more about watches themselves, which we sort of touched on already. So shall I kick off Zach first? Because I was so looking forward to this. I definitely want to go first. So hopefully an easy one to kick off. And perhaps we can rotate the responses, if you like. So Rebecca first, then Alon, and then we switch with Alon going first, then Rebecca. I suppose, why make a book about time for children? And why do it now?
Well, I suppose. I mean, this book came out of Alon and I talking about how good horology is as a subject for educating kids with science and history. So it kind of came about quite naturally, really. We were trustees of the Museum of Timekeeping in Newark together for a time. And we just realised that no one had ever really done anything quite like this before. So we thought, well, that's a good time to be doing it. There's clearly a gap in the market. And being a physics teacher and a watchmaker is a pretty unique combination to tackle a subject like this as well. So it means we really can play to our strengths. It does key into many other things. Like we've got a critical global shortage of watchmakers at the moment. So, in some ways that means that we're too late because we're already short of people. But, the next best day is today to be doing this. We need more collectors. The industry needs more support. And, this is no better way to start that than with the next generation.
That sounds really good. What about you, Alan? Was that the inspiration then?
Yeah, Rebecca and I met as part of a mentoring group for other writers, and what we immediately connected because of our interest in watches. And Rebecca asked me to join her on the board of Museum of Timekeeping, and we were in their bookshop, and it was very evident that there weren't any books for children. So it sounds silly, but one of us said, "Why don't we write one?" And so we did, which is a really lovely story. I wish projects were always so easy, but yeah.
Oh, that sounds really, really good. And as I said before, I've got three young children, so definitely want to get them to tell the time, and I'll definitely be getting the book, perhaps signed by you both, and then I can start introducing as they get older and appreciate time just as much as I do. Zach, do you want to go for the next question?
Yeah, definitely. Tell us about the book. How it came to be and what's included and what didn't make the cut.
I think we said a bit about how it came to be, but what didn't make the cut? My goodness. I think we could have written another 2-3 books, couldn't we, Alon, out of what didn't make it in?
Yeah, I think writing this kind of book for this publisher, so Dorling Kindersley have a very particular approach to their books, so we had to be very limited in what we could do in terms of how much content we could include. So, you know, there was lots more about watchmaking we could have included. And there was lots more about the science of timekeeping that we could have included. But I think between us, we did agree on a kind of list of contents which we felt would give readers a good overview of the subject of horology, if you like, both the science and the history, and indeed the kind of cultural significance of timekeeping. And one of the things I think we're both really proud of is that if you read the book, you get a sense that making watches is a contemporary activity. It's something that people alive are now doing. And so the section on contemporary artisans, which I think I'm really glad the publisher agreed to it, because I think it really makes the book stand out. I don't think anybody else would have thought to include that. And that's definitely, you know, Rebecca's influence. She's a practicing watchmaker. And I think lots of adults who have been reading the book have commented on the kind of breadth. I think it does have breadth. We could have gone into more depth on lots of aspects of it, but I think actually what we're hoping to do is just to inspire an interest in these topics that we've covered, and hopefully young readers will go on to seek out more information for themselves.
Fantastic. Awesome. I think that's really interesting what you mentioned. And then also what Rebecca mentioned about not having enough people like now getting into it. So hopefully this your book or your definitely feeds into that and inspires a lot of that young generation.
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I work, as I said, in the energy industry, and we obviously have to build, like, the grid for the future in terms of getting lots of, you know, offshore wind, onshore, and I suppose the geography of energy has changed as well in terms of we used to be getting, you know, from the coal pits, basically. So, you know, we don't have enough linesmen to make, pylons. We don't have enough people to lay cables, that kind of thing. So the skills aren't there. I suppose it's similar for watches, right? You're trying to inspire young people to get into sort of watchmaking in loads of different ways. I think I read the other day, what do kids want to be when they grow up? And the top thing was to be a YouTube star. So there you go. I know this will be on YouTube, but you know what I mean, in terms of having a skill. And again, I suppose, even though I'm getting older, as we all are, I've never really stopped liking video games, but I always see it from almost like an artistic perspective. You know, the musicians of yesteryear and musicians today, they could write an amazing original score for a video game, or artists that you would see in the Louvre or wherever, you know, those artists could render video games now. I suppose it's the same, you know, with watches. You could get someone who's an amazing a budding artist, but they could channel that into, I don't know, working for Jaeger and working on enameling, for example, on watches. So I think, you know, it's trying to get more young people into industries, I guess, Rebecca, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, the interdisciplinary thing you mentioned is really important part of it too, because we have a lot of people studying subjects like illustration at university when there's very few illustration careers out there. It's incredibly competitive. And yet the skills between illustration and things like whether it's micro painting or engraving, there's so much of an overlap there. And we need more people doing those things, especially on the enamelling front. So just raising awareness that these careers exist, which is, as Alan mentioned, why it was so important to us to include the contemporary artisan spreads in there, was because we wanted to show that these are real jobs. You know, this is something that you can do and have a really cool and exciting career in. Yeah, the micro
painter. Highly skilled as well.
Yeah. The enamel micro painter who we featured, Xingwei, her cat is in there, featured in there too. So that's on another page, so you have to look out. There's a few my dog's in there as well. So
these Easter eggs are in there.
Yes, they are. Very they good. Are. If you're looking out for them.
Oh, excellent. So I've got the next question. So was there something that you learned while writing the book that surprised you, or do you know everything there is to know about watches and you didn't have a surprise?
You'll never know everything in this subject. You're always, always learning. I think one of my most exciting facts is probably very juvenile of me, but I didn't realise a jiffy was an actual unit of time.
Oh.
So there you go. I think
it's... I didn't know that, no.
1/100th of a second along. Does that sound right?
I can't remember off the top of my head, but it is an absolute fraction of a second, yes.
Yeah. I don't know if anyone's actually achieved something in a jiffy. Like, I feel like that should be a Guinness World Record.
As I've seen a review where someone also comments on finding the fact that the jiffy is a real unit of time quite interesting. For me,
You go.
No, I really liked so Linnaeus is obviously somebody I'd heard about as a science teacher. But I Rebecca introduced me to the fact that he had designed a clock made of flowers that bloom at different times of the day. And apparently nobody's successfully tried to grow it, and it wouldn't be terribly accurate, but maybe that's a project for me in my old age when I take up gardening.
Yeah, I love that conversation, actually, because I said at the time, like, it's really cool, but I don't think anyone's ever managed to get one work, so maybe we shouldn't include it. And it was Alan who was saying, no, we should absolutely include it, for that reason, because it's so important to show kids that things don't have to work. You've got to keep experimenting to learn. You've got to try stuff out. And the experiments that don't work can teach us just as much, if not more, than the ones that do. So I thought that was a cool approach. Yeah.
No, definitely. Maybe the people at Grand Seiko could maybe try the flower thing. I'm sure they'd be good at it. The Japanese usually are, aren't they? And I can just imagine, you talk about the jiffy. You can imagine Houston space station or at the ground talking about, we need to get this done in a jiffy or whatever, and they actually mean a jiffy to get this, really complicated, physics up in the air or whatever, to say a jiffy, especially in an American voice, would probably quite amuse me. So, I've definitely learned two new things. Zach, do you want to go with the last question, I think, about the book before we go into the philosophical ones?
Sure. So I remember making a sundial at primary school and being amazed. That's in the book. Can you share other moments like that?
I think the sundial. So I didn't make a sundial at school. And the first time I made a sundial, we've included activities in the book and we've tried them all out for ourselves to make sure that they work. So I made a sundial and, I felt it really connected me to the kind of ancient ways of thinking about time that humans had before we had watches and clocks. And the fact that the way we measure the passing of time depends on these kind of natural phenomena. And the first most obvious passage of time that I think humans probably noticed was the passage between night and day and the movement of what they would have thought would have been the kind of earth, the sun around the earth. But, for me, actually making my own sundial and observing the shadow changing and so forth, it was really quite a, for want of a better word, a kind of spiritual experience connecting me to what we were talking about in the book, that, measuring time is such a kind of central part of our culture, of what it means to be human. And yet we all take it for granted now, and except, obviously people like Rebecca don't, because they make watches and Rebecca is a horologist, but lots of people who have read the book already have just said to us, I've never thought about this stuff, because time is just, we're like fish in water. Time is just taken for granted. The fact that we can measure time accurately is taken for granted, and very few people stop to think about what is it we're measuring, where does this idea of time come from? And making a sundial for me just really connected me to that kind of ancient pre-mechanical, pre-electrical timekeeping. I hope lots of other people try it.
Well, that's really interesting. I haven't actually experienced making one as of recent, but I feel like this kind of conversation has made me want to go back to the essence and try making one again, Alan.
Yeah, I vividly remember doing it at school, similar to you, Zach. Did you do a water clock as well? I didn't think I did that, but is that in the book as well?
Yeah. Yep, so a water clock is just another way of measuring out kind of units of time. But for me, as I said, what's special about a sundial is that it connects you to the way the very first humans were observing the passage of time and the fact that, you know, the first clock is a celestial one. It's, you know, it's the first ways we had of kind of observing this kind of regular change, what was up in the sky. I think there's something quite profound about that. And that's again, comes back to why I'd quite like a moon phase watch, because it's a complication that harks back to an ancient way of timekeeping.
No, definitely. Got to check out that Omega Cosmic, Alon, because I do love those. They're from the 1950s, but they're incredible. Yeah, Rebecca, what about for you?
I mean, moon phase indication is my favourite complication of them all. And I think because, like Alon was saying, it takes us back to how humans first started noticing the passage of time. And the earliest calendars that we have, some of those are lunar calendars. So I love that we are still capable of mechanically measuring something that we've been measuring for tens of thousands of years. It's pretty cool, I think.
Yeah.
And even something as basic as keeping a lunar diary. Like, I love nature. And it's about 6 years ago now, I moved to a little town that's surrounded by countryside and moorland. And I love being out in nature. And you notice things like that so much more. And it's such a privilege. I'm noticing the passage of the seasons and migration of animals, stuff like that. And being able to see the moon properly, regularly is lovely. And you feel time passing when you go from kind of full moon to full moon and think, God, is that a month already? I haven't done anything I need to do. it's beautiful.
No, that is nice. I get that with my kids as well. So, you know, as they get older and they retain memories, the Conquerors are obviously out at the moment, you know, and I remember what it was like a year ago with the Conquerors. And similarly, we've got wildflowers, you know, in fields near where I am, you know, and that's sort of come around again, and the kids sort of remember it. They don't remember when it happened, but they remember the moments. I suppose it's moments in time as well that sort of stay with you as well. So, but that's really good. So have I got the next question? I think we're moving to more philosophical questions, I think, which I wanted to put in there.
That's correct,
So I'm not asking for the truth here. I'm just asking for a response, or perhaps we can debate the philosophical points. But do you think young people today have a proper appreciation of time? Or do you just think it's a natural life cycle? You know, when you're young, you think you've got all the time in the world. But as you get older, time just seems to, like in a sand dial, it just sort of ebbs away. So I don't know, Alon, if you wanted to go first to try and answer that, and then Rebecca.
I think our relationship with time definitely changes as we age. And there's the obvious thing that when you're very young, you know, below 10 years of age or whatever, a year is a huge proportion of your life, and so it feels like a long time. And then by the time you get to our age, a year is a tiny fraction of what you've lived. So time seems to whiz past. So, there are good reasons why our perception of time changes. But in terms of how we feel about how much time we've got left, I think it's very difficult when you're a young person to appreciate that. We talk about this in the book, that we all have a limited amount of time. It's a finite resource for all of us. And unfortunately, as you get older, you definitely get more of a sense of that. I'm like you. I'm a dad to two young children, and to me it feels like they're growing up at a rate of knots. Whereas for them, they can't wait to be older. They want to be teenagers already. They want to be adults already. So we'd probably give anything to go back to our youth. So I think. Our personal sense of our time, the time that we are each allotted, is central to our sense of who we are at different stages in our lives. But that definitely changes. I feel very keenly aware that I would love to live to see my daughters the same age as I am now. And I know that's not likely, you know, because I'd have to live to over 100. But this sounds depressing, doesn't it? Somebody read the book and said that we were very brave to open a children's book. Like in the first opening spread, we talk about that very fact, that we all have a limited amount of time. But I think it's a fact worth appreciating as soon as you can, because I think once you do appreciate that, I think you tend to value it more and make the most of it.
No, 100%. I totally agree. It's definitely what you do with it. Rebecca, I don't know if you've got any other reflections on that. Perhaps even like this current generation, or are we doomed to live that cycle of time where you're young and you feel like all the time in the world, and then as you get older, you feel it running out? Or is there something particular about this generation where perhaps it's slightly different?
Yeah, I'm going to move around in a creaky chair and get myself a Strepsil out quickly so I can feel my
voice. That's right, don't worry.
Yeah, I think that experience of time speeding up as we get older is an inevitability of just being human, I guess. But I think kind of our experience of time on a day-to-day basis isn't just to do with age. I think it is generational, and it does change over the decades and centuries as well. I mean, if you look at the earliest watches and the earliest clocks as well, were made with an hour hand only. They didn't have a minute hand. And although part of the reason for that is they just weren't accurate enough to warrant a minute hand, it also tells us a lot about society at the time. And if you go back 500 years ago, knowing the time, even to the minute, just wasn't important. It wasn't a relevant thing to us. It was okay to know roughly the time of day to meet, you know, at the public square when the sun was high in the sky, and that you'd be vaguely there at roughly the same time, and that was fine. You know, we had a very different relationship with time, and I think the feeling of time speeding up for us generally because of technology and the impact of technology. We were talking about training earlier. One of the big challenges I think craft disciplines across the board face is they take so long to learn. And we're trying to convince a generation who are used to having everything at their fingertips in an instant to actually, you know what, don't do this in an instant. Take the next 10 years studying this and you might be half decent at it at the end of it, is really tough, because everything is just so quick. Everything is so instant. And that is going to change people's experience of time, I think, in more than just our age. It's the age of humanity as well as our age as individuals.
That's a really good point, Zach. I think teeing up the next question, which you've got a crack over here, so I'll let you go ask it.
So how do digital devices like iPhones, Apple Watches impact children's sense of time, help or hindrance?
I think one of the problems with digital times is that it's not connected to this fundamental physical way in which we actually arrive at keeping time. So what one of the beauties of an analog watch, in my opinion, you know, you see a hand go round, and that kind of mirrors the kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier, mirrors the kind of orbit of the Earth around the sun, the fact that it's a repetitive regular motion that you see on a mechanical watch. And I think that to me, digital watches just don't have the same sense of time passing in the way that it does in the universe, if that makes any sense. But the other thing is that digital devices all with the time on them somewhere, like on your phone, you've got the time, or, you know, if you've got a computer game, a portable computer game, it's got the time on it or whatever. It makes time just another thing, just another quantity that your phone will tell you or whatever, when actually, you know, I think time's much more important than that. And that's why I think wearing a wristwatch that is dedicated to telling the time is different to wearing a smartwatch. That's probably me just being snobby and a kind of watch nerd. But, you know, I think digital time being available on every single device, you know, that I can see the time in the corner of my computer here. It just makes time kind of less significant in a way. Whereas a watch, you know, it's about time. You know, it exists to tell you the time. It's an instrument that is dedicated to telling you the time, and digital time, just it's a kind of, oh, it's just another thing that it does. Does that make sense?
No, I think so. I think you're a man after my own heart here, because as I was saying about my dad, he works in television, in sound, but he always wanted a countdown clock to be analog. You know, before it's the 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and we go live. And he said when they moved to digital, he absolutely hated it. And that's what stuck with me. And similarly, I've got this memory as a child where I was at my grandparents' house. We obviously went to bed earlier than everyone else, but always the door would be slightly ajar and I could see the analog clock and I could see the time just tick by. And I was obviously in my own thoughts, but I sort of think about it sort of almost like emotionally as well about watching the passage of time on analog clock as opposed to a digital one. Rekha, I don't know whether you are pro digital or is there a space for digital in your world, or are you very much analog clock?
Oh dear, I'm gonna sell myself out here, aren't I? I mean, in terms of things like smartwatches, so yeah. I don't have a smartwatch, never have, never desired one. I don't have a problem with them. It's just I find technology can get me in enough places as it is. I don't want it getting me on my wrist as well. So I've got emails coming in, no phone calls. I like to be able to switch off. So I like a watch to be a watch. I do like digital watches. So I'm a total Casio geek. Casio's are my workshop watch of choice. And my first watch memory as a kid was a Baby G G-Shock.
Yeah.
And buying my first Baby G for myself was that was a big deal. So I love them, but I love them to just tell the time, whether it's digital or analog. I've got love really beautiful old 1920s, 30s Art Deco watches, and I love modern Casio. It doesn't matter to me as long as it's only telling me the time. That's my life.
I think we're of a similar age, but I remember sort of the G-Shock and the Baby G stuff in the 90s, and you know, you weren't cool if you didn't have one of those and all the different colours and everything. So it definitely brings me back to that time.
In the Argos catalogue.
Absolutely, absolutely. The Argos catalogue.
Parents, yeah.
I remember that fondly. So this one was about AI and technology. So sort of with I suppose AI accelerating everything. You know, Zach was talking to me about something earlier and using ChatGPT, which I've never actually used, by the way. And my own work is starting to use it, and I'm a bit sort of reticent about using it. I think it's more like Terminator 2, and they're going to take over. But I mean, things for me, you know, even when I first started working, you know, I'd have to go to a library and find the answer, and that could take hours or even days. But now I can look it on the internet and it takes maybe 10 minutes or minutes. What do you think about the advent of AI? Do you think it's going to sort of alter our concepts of time in terms of just collapsing around us? So I suppose philosophically, there's no right or wrong answer. I don't know, Rebecca, if you want to go first and then I'll.
Yeah. I mean, I think it already has, to be honest. As I mentioned previously about the immediacy of information now, like gone are the days where you had to go and find a book at your local library to be able to figure out what you wanted to know. You put it into a search engine and it's there. So I think that has definitely already changed our concept of time. How it all changed the arts and crafts more broadly, it's a different subject, but certainly in our time perception, I think that's already happened.
I mean, I haven't really thought about how AI might affect timekeeping or anything like that, but I think we can't. Well, one of the things we do with time is try and predict the future, right? That's that we all want to kind of know what things will be like in the future, and I think we're usually very bad at making predictions. So I think, you know, if you look at the internet today, when I was in the 90s getting my first email address and, doing some very basic searching, you know, I certainly didn't envisage social media or, the fact that you and I would be sitting here recording a podcast thanks to the internet. Those things were unimagined by most ordinary people. And I suspect the same is true of AI. I think at the moment, I think it's being hyped beyond any kind of actual capability of what it does. But I think people want to make money from it and so forth. But I think it's here to stay. And I think its uses and applications and consequences will probably be very different to what we're being told that they will be. So, Yeah, I'm reluctant to kind of make any comment beyond the fact that we should wait and see, and not and in terms of applications that work, I think, you know, it's very controversial. I think there are places where it could make a positive difference, and yet there are also things like the creative industries which I think will suffer. And you know, even in my work as a writer, I know that there is work I will not be getting because, for example, educational publishers have already decided that they will produce new educational texts by putting their old educational texts through a kind of LLM or whatever they're called. So, you know, there will be consequences for all of us, sometimes negative, perhaps positive ones as well. I don't know.
I suppose even like ownership of it, you know, I've got people at work, obviously different, not going to name names, but you know, they use a lot, they use it in that so much, and you know, they present their work back and you just think, but is it the ownership, is it actually yours? And similarly, I was reading an article the other day about actors, like voice actors, you know, you can digitize you know, someone's voice and adapt it and manipulate it. I think they were talking about, you know, Robin Williams, you know, God rest his soul, he's not with us anymore, but you could keep him using his voice for so many things, even though he's not with us anymore. And it just kind of seems a bit creepy and a bit weird. So, yeah, I don't think I'm the biggest fan of AI and all those kind of things. But yes, maybe a longer conversation. I did have another question before we go into like the love of watches in particular to sort of just round us out. But Rebecca, really keen to sort of get your insight in particular on sort of what mindset do young people need to sort of get into watches, you know, because I'm definitely not an engineer, and I really love aesthetics. So that's where my love of sort of watches come from. But, you know, is it an art or a science? Is there a blend? Just again, for our listeners and trying to get young people sort of a bit in, you know, interested in watches, you know, what kind of mindset do you need to be able to achieve the things that you achieve or others?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very much an art and a science. So you've got to understand the science and be creative with it. Which is why I love it so much, because I've always loved those two subjects since I was a kid. And then one of the reasons I really struggled at school and I ended up dropping out before I finished my A-levels was because I felt so pigeonholed into being a scientist if I was going to have a successful career. And I miss art, but I love science. Yeah, so you can do both. Basically, it's a wonderful career for people who love both. And I think something I certainly was like when I was younger, and it seems to be a trait shared by a lot of engineers, whichever branch of engineering they've gone into, is an obsession with understanding how things work. Just whether it's understanding how the world works, why we have day and night, kind of why the solar system moves in the way that it does, to understanding how the watch on your wrist ticks. It's that passion for wanting to know more. And I think if you've got that, that's a fantastic place to start. If you want to be a watchmaker, or if you just love watches and love following the stories of watchmakers, because you're following how they're making things, really. And there's the same sort of skills involved.
Definitely. And I suppose you're creating something as well, like tangible, because I think, again, you know, in this world, people make these sort of digital products or services, and they seem to be sort of king or queen, as it were, whereas for actually you've made something with your hands, you know, be it, you know, engineering or, you know, artistry. And obviously that stays with someone and goes on the journey. So, yeah, definitely appreciate
that. Yeah, it's something so beautifully human about being able to wake up with an idea one morning and then make that idea a reality. You know, maybe it's a watch, maybe it's a spice rack for at home, maybe it's a cake. You know, it doesn't really matter. It's just that real human urge that we have to just create things, come up with ideas and make, let it loose.
Few questions on watches. So Alan, we'll go with you first. Do you have a favorite luxury watch brand, and perhaps like a specific watch itself, and perhaps the same for any micro brands that you like? I know we talked about it before we came on air, but yeah, over to you for your sort of favorite luxury watch and perhaps micro brand that you may have.
Luxury watch, I'm very lucky, so I'm quite a small man. And when I was younger, I had the good fortune to be able to afford bespoke suits and clothing, which I can't afford anymore. But so if I was going to have a luxury watch, it would have to be a bespoke one. And I'm sure Rebecca can tell you who I'd order one from, although Struthers no longer do bespoke. But at some point, they may well offer the service again. So, yeah, I think if I could have any watch that I wanted, I would definitely go bespoke, because then I would have a one of a kind watch with all the kind of features that I wanted. So that would be my choice. And sorry, what was the second part of that?
Micro brands, obviously, because that's bursting on the scene now. Is there any that have caught your eye that you particularly like?
So there's a Japanese band called, I think they're cool, I don't know how to pronounce it, KUOE. Do you know them?
Yes, I've heard of them. Yes, I won't go with the pronunciation.
So I like them because they do kind of classic watches with a kind of classic looking watches at a very affordable price point. And also another thing that determines whether I want a watch or not is that they're very small dial size. I've got really small wrists, which is why I like vintage watches. And this Japanese company, I think most of their watches are 36 mil diameters. And they look really nice. I've kind of not quite bought one yet, but I suspect I might fork out for one of them soon.
Very good. What about you, Rebecca?
Well, I'm a bit of a magpie when it comes to watches, so I don't really have a specific luxury brand because there's just so many pieces. I'm more about the pieces than I am about the brand. Like,
sure, yeah.
A loyalist in that respect. But if I was going to choose one from a watchmaker's perspective, one of the watchmakers that I really admire the most in terms of their design and creative outlook would be someone like Kari Vuitilainen. Because I love his approach as a watchmaker and his collaborative approach when it comes to things like the artistry in his dials, so the artistic crafts pieces that he creates. I love it. It's just like a celebration of the art of watchmaking in all of its forms. And he does that so well. I think that a really inspiring watchmaker for me. And then micro brands, same sort of thing again. I'm going to have to give another shout out for my homeboys, Denison. Not that they're homeboys anymore, they're in Switzerland. But I love them. I love Studio Underdog. Some of their recent advertising is just crazy and I adore it. I look for that. Have you seen their recent launch?
No, I haven't. I haven't seen that yet.
Check that out. It is like full Wes Anderson weirdness. It's just beautiful. Oh, wow.
Gosh, my wife likes Wes Anderson, but Wes Anderson, I always find his films a bit hard to take in, but I suppose each to their own. The pizza watch and everything else, but Denison, we talked about it earlier, definitely really like them, and Baltic as well. I really like what they're doing, so tell us a bit more about sort of your watch collections, and maybe how your sort of tastes have changed over time. I don't know, Breck, if you want to go first. You probably got lots of watches, right?
Too many. Vintage and Casios. So that tends to be that. I don't know if I've got any. Have I got modern watches that aren't Casio? I must do. But I love weird eclectic things as well. So I've got an incredibly tiny watch by Benson that is, I think it's about a centimetre across, that I just love because it's so ridiculously small. I mean, you can barely read it. It's ridiculous. But I love stuff like that. I've got a few vintage Tiffany. The one I wore to the Watch of Switzerland event last week, that was a Cress Arrow Movement Tiffany from the 1930s, so original New York one. Yeah. So I like the earlier stuff. Then vintage, a couple of vintage Rolexes too, just because again I like the early bits.
Yeah, so do I.
Egyptian lug and Bouchereau retailed from the 1930s, and a very very early Air King from late 40s early 50s. Some weird waterproof watches that, like, not particularly brand, but again we love design, so just case designs that didn't really work when they were new, let alone now. So early waterproof wristwatches, interesters, and early automatic winding. So okay. We've got an auto wrist, which is the one where you flex your wrist and the lugs move. It's insanely impractical. It doesn't really work, and it literally breaks itself as it runs, so they all wear out pretty quickly. But I mean, yeah, it's a ridiculous design and I love it. So lots of strange things like that. Yeah.
Cool. I do like vintage Rolexes as well. I'm not like a modern Rolex kind of guy. But the things from sort of 30s, 40s, 50s is absolutely incredible. Just in terms of, they were just so creative, both sort of inside and outside the watch. Whereas now it just seems to be more mass produced, which is a shame. But yeah, Alan, you were talking about your love of Nomos as well before you came on.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have one in my very small not collection. Yet. But talking of watches we've collected. So, unfortunately I was burgled a few years ago, the burglars took watches that I'd had since I was a young man, all of which were gifts and of huge sentimental value. And, my favorite of the bunch was a Seiko 5, model SNK301. And it was, I'd had it for over 20 years and it was still in mint condition, still keeping good time. And I failed to locate one on the internet. So if any of your listeners know of one in good condition, I'll happily buy it off them. And the Seiko 5 had kind of real significance. So I was born in Bangladesh, and when I was growing up in kind of 1970s, 1980s London, whenever family went back home, if you ask people back home, you know, what would you like from London? What I think the kind of best thing you could get them was a Seiko 5. And a Seiko 5, I'm sure you know, is just it's a really good function. It's an automatic, and it was kind of, you know, we used to joke it was a Bangladeshi Rolex. And I know even today people refer to kind of Seiko 5s as a poor man's Rolex. And as a kid, I really wanted one because my dad and lots of the other men on the estate where we lived had Seiko 5s. So all the kids wanted a Seiko 5. So and I got my first one when I was about 19, 20. And it was a friend of mine who bought it for me in a shop on Brick Lane, which was kind of Banglatown. And it just had a huge sentimental value. And I don't have a Seiko 5 at the moment. And I'm hoping I might find one that feels like the old one used to feel. Also, I don't, you know, I'm not sure I want a new one. I kind of want a 1990s one.
Oh, nice. No, it's a nice, obviously sad story about how you came to lose them. You know, this happened to so many people and it seems to come more and more frequent. But it's having those, it's about creating memories. It's how I got into watches as well. You know, the first watch that I bought, as I like to call it, was a World War II watch. It was an Omega, for it was 1943, and it had also the blue steeled hands. Again, it was, you know, really crisp and clear. And I wanted to, you know, I'm going to hand it down to my firstborn son, perhaps not when he's 18, because I remember myself being 18 and being quite reckless, maybe even at 21. So maybe when he gets his first house or gets married, perhaps when he's far more sensible, I'd like him to have that. When you buy a watch, you create memory at the point of getting it, and then obviously you build onto it as well. So all great stories. So Rebecca, I was going to turn to you, but then Alan, you might have a view on this too. Do you have like a favorite material to sort of work with, in watchmaking, be that like a particular dial or case as well, that you might like using in terms of materials?
Oh, gold. Gold is beautiful to work with. I mean, I trained as a jeweler and silversmith before a watchmaker, and I am not at all surprised that our ancestors have been obsessed with gold for thousands of years. It is just, it's like butter, but obviously a lot harder. But just the way it finishes, the way it turns, the way it cuts, the way you can like polish it and get that, just the way it catches the light, and the way when you're working it leaves your hands sparkling with gold as well. It just looks magical. It's such a beautiful material to work with. And obviously the higher carats as well, they're well, they're not magnetic and they don't tarnish. So you've got something that's really sort of everlasting, very thermally stable. So it's a brilliant engineering material, just really expensive as well. But yeah, just beautiful to work with. And kind of ties back to when I first started training as a jeweler and a silversmith, the goldsmith who was teaching my course, he retired the year I left and he'd started his apprenticeship at 13. So it's wow. Proper old school. It's an Austrian guy. He's absolutely incredible. And I remember early on in my career, I was going to try and make something out of silver and gilding metal, which is like a copper alloy, because I couldn't afford gold. And he stopped me and he was like, no, you're going to make this design out of gold, Rebecca. And he ended up sorting me some out from the university supplies to help me do that. Because his philosophy was, you've got to work in materials worthy of your time. And it's so true, because if you're hand make a watch case, it doesn't matter whether you're hand making steel or hand making gold, it's taking you the same amount of time. Whereas you can charge a lot more for the gold piece than you can for the steel piece. So it is respecting your time with the materials that you work with. And that will allow you to if you're going to handcraft something, handcraft it properly out of a material that's worth your time. And that stuck with me for life. Yeah.
I know, that's really fascinating. Does it matter in terms of like the type of gold, like a rose gold or white gold or just normal gold, you know, I suppose 9-carat, 18-carat, it's just gold more broadly that you like working with?
The nicest one is yellow gold, and like 18 carat is just beautiful to work with. I'm not a huge fan of modern rose gold, 9 or 18 or any other carat, because the materials they use in it now, it's got quite a high copper content, even the higher carats, which means it oxidizes really quickly, so it's right pain in the bum to solder. So it just goes black instantly and then the solder won't run on it. So I'd rather, we try and steer people away from rose gold. Obviously we will if someone really wants us to, but yellow is the natural colour of gold, so it's what it wants to be and it's how it works really nicely. White's nice to work with too, but yellow. And I love yellow gold watches with yellow gold dials as well. It's my thing.
I quite like rose gold. Again, because I'm not a particularly big fan of like the colour of gold. Obviously, I'd never be Olympian. I've always wanted, even if I came first, I'd want a silver medal, not a gold one. But if it was rose gold, then that would be quite nice. But I actually quite like bronze as well. So I've got this Oris Pointer today. I've got it in bronze. And again, obviously, because it reacts, with nature and oxygen and around it, obviously it creates this sort of wonderful sort of effect. Because I'm almost like, when I'm perspiring, I'm almost changing the watch as I wear it. So not everyone likes bronze watches, but the Oris Big Crown Pointer today in the bronze, I particularly like. Yeah. Mm. What about you, Alan? Is there sort of a particular sort of type of material or like case design that you really, really appreciate and like?
No, well, like you, I don't particularly like the look of gold, but again, I wouldn't turn down a gold watch if anybody wanted to buy me one. So it's been fascinating kind of listening to Rebecca talk about the kind of engineering side of making watches and all the things she has to consider when she's making a watch. And I've learned so much, and going back to what you were saying about young people and so forth, if I was 20 years younger, I would definitely retrain as a watchmaker. But also, I didn't know it was a thing someone like me could do, one of the things I think Rebecca kind of exemplifies and we hope the book conveys is that watchmaking really does bring together science, engineering, craft and art in a way that I think would be really satisfying to lots of young people who are both creative and techie. I wish I'd had the opportunity to become to even consider watchmaking when I was a young person. So, and I'm sure that the material scientists will come up with fancy new materials that will engage watchmakers. So Rebecca was just telling me about silicon springs, right? And how they're anti-magnetic and so forth. And I know that as scientists and engineers develop new materials, watchmakers will definitely think, oh yeah, that'll be good for making that bit of a watch or making that a bit better. And then that's one of the things, you know, Rebecca and I discussed early on about what's really fascinating about watchmaking from a physics teacher point of view is that the kind of properties of materials are really important in deciding what material you're going to use for which particular component and so forth. So, you know, I think there's probably a whole book we could have written about the kind of physical properties of matter and how they determine their use in watchmaking.
No, I was just going to throw in diamonds as well. This is the most expensive things in life. They're also usually the best ones to work with. Diamonds. Diamonds are amazing, again, for their physical properties, for being so hard-wearing, so light, that they're anti-magnetic. So they're not light. diamonds are wonderful to work with. I spoke to an engineer recently who was explaining to me that they'd run a load of analysis, their lab, and the best material to make a canoe out of was diamond. It's just the technology that would be required to do it just mean it's just completely, it's impossible. Yeah. Like, it'd just be astronomically expensive, but apparently diamond would theoretically be a great material to make a canoe from. So wow. Who knows? But that's technology.
Forget these super yachts that millionaires have. You need a diamond canoe, yeah, right?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose also I quite like what Omega are doing recently in terms of the meteorite dials as well. So I went in to see those, and that sort of turned my head a bit as well. It's quite pricey, and I think one of them, the recent one they've got, has got a moon phase complication as well. Obviously added into the mix, because that's my final question. Do you have a favorite complication? But I think as we've gone on throughout the throughout this conversation, you mentioned that the moon phase is definitely a number one, and it's definitely, I think, one of mine, definitely up there.
I love moon phases. I will throw in the Valjoux 90 as a caliber there, because I love working with that. We've just we're making a series of four watches. That's our last of what we're calling the tailor-made, where we use a heritage caliber. The Valjoux 90 is that base, and three of those are moon phase watches.
Oh, lovely. Because I think Farrier released a watch a couple of years back, and it's moon phase, but it's not small. It's almost like the whole dial. The moon phase, the actual colour of it is more like pinky. So it's almost like a red moon that I've always quite liked. So I think I almost want to start a campaign to bring the moon phase back and have it more mainstream and have people design that up. That'd be really good. I'm sure you would agree, both of you as well.
Definitely.
Wonderful. So I think we'll draw it to a close. So thank you so much, Rebecca and Alan, for joining us today. It's always amazing to get, your insights and stories. Don't forget to check out, their book, About Time. If you haven't already, there's a children's guide to history and science of timekeeping. So as always, we'll be showing our favourite sort of Insta shots of the month next time. And we'll have other guests on as well. So make sure you're following us on Instagram, the Timekeepers 2024, and also myself at Watchword and Zach at Source Watches. And you can, of course, listen or watch the full podcast wherever you get your pods. So that's Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube, and all the usual places. Just sort of 10, 15 seconds, Rebecca, Alon, thank you just so much for coming on, and really appreciate you having us on the show. And I'm sure our listeners will love it as well, and give us lots of feedback in the comments. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Definitely. It's going to be in my Christmas stocking book as well. So that's what I'm very much looking forward to. Brilliant. Like I said, definitely I'm going to look for a signed copy. So I'll speak to Kirsty after this. Wonderful. Cool. Thank you so much. And Timekeepers, that's us, over and out.